Welcome to episode one of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast with your co-host Eric Drysdale.
And I'm Jared Hunter.
On our inaugural podcast episode, we're going to be talking about Canadian politics. Jared and I are both proud Canadians and have discussed many a theme during our 18 floors of stairwalks at the Hospital for Sick Children, where
the
we both work.
Exercise really gets the ideas flowing.
Yes, absolutely. You should talk about politics while your blood pressure is going up. And so we want to review some of the things we've often talked about. We're not going to dive too deeply into any contemporary statistics or news articles, although we'll make reference to a few of them, kind of more high-level ideas of what's driving Canadian politics these days. Mm-hmm. So I want to start by just giving a recap of the 2019 election. So I took a look at the Wikipedia articles today, and for those of you who aren't keeping track, the Liberals went from 184 seats, which was a majority in 2015, you need 170 to form one in Canada, to 157. And they lost seats in every single province. They went from 12 seats in the Prairies and 17 seats in BC, all the way down to 4 seats in the Prairies and 11 BC. In BC, so it was a wipeout in the West, and actually they gained one seat in Ontario from 79 to 80. Otherwise, the Conservatives gained seats in every single province except Quebec, where they lost two seats, no doubt because Scheer can't speak French very well. But otherwise, there was gains from the Atlantic to BC. So, ironically enough, despite the gains that the Conservatives saw in virtually every single region, Scheer was deemed to be the loser of this election. So how do we make sense of this, Jared?
Well, I think the impression going into the election was just that it was the Conservatives' election to lose or to win.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And they basically had what was deemed a significant advantage going in. There was a lot of scandals that had plagued Justin Trudeau for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Way back even with just India, mm-hmm. the India trip. SNC-Lavalin, and then even into blackface,
mm-hmm.
That...
Black and brown face, Jared.
Black and brown face.
Mm-hmm.
That basically people consider that as it should have sunk Justin Trudeau, and so why were the Conservatives not able to to take advantage of a weak prime minister and a party that was in the majority and then hadn't been seen as doing as good of a job as it could have been?
Mm-hmm. Although they did, I mean, the Liberals lost seats in every province except Ontario, where they gained only a single seat. So basically no difference. And
yeah.
Scheer did gain seats across the board. So, I mean, in terms of if the goal is to ultimately seize power, most prime ministers are not defeated after a single term. Just statistically speaking, that doesn't happen that often.
This is true.
So minus the natural reaction of having lost an election, wanting to blame someone, is it actually fair that Scheer is taking this much heat from the Conservative Party?
Well, I still think so, because if we looked at a lot of the polls, the Conservatives were ahead for many different points during the government,
mm-hmm.
right? It seemed like that Justin Trudeau was deeply unpopular,
mm-hmm.
that there was many people that were turning against him.
Mm-hmm.
There was, a lot of anger in Alberta that they knew they were going to be able to basically wipe the Liberals out of Alberta entirely, pick up seats there, but then they weren't able to take anything in the 905, basically, is where they needed to win. Personally, I didn't ever really like Andrew Scheer's brand of conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was not actually offering anything new. It was trying to just get elected on the fact that they were not the Liberals. And so, I guess in my mind, that was why they weren't able to get actually any momentum, because they needed people to actually get on side when... Basically, they just had Andrew Scheer and even a platform that no one could get excited about.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. It felt less that there was a conservative vision and more that what Scheer wanted you to believe, which is probably true, was that the liberal vision was phony.
Yeah.
Not that they had one to propose as an alternative. And I think having released your, say, climate platform a week before the election, it was a little more than a week, but it felt like it was very close.
Yeah.
Added to that, the view that a lot of people had.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of winning every seat in Alberta except one, I think. I think the NDP won a single seat.
The NDP did win one seat in Edmonton, I'm sure.
Yeah, okay. So we're from BC.
Yes, we're so, both Vancouver boys.
Yeah, so we're sort of part of Wexit.
I would not actually say that we're part of Wexit, actually. Okay. I mean, okay. I don't think there's quite as much separatist... Like, the anger doesn't seem to extend to at least the lower mainland of BC.
Mm, okay, right? I mean, they did take some lower mainland seats, though. That, like, they took, like...
well, but I mean, so Delta, there's the Conservatives having won back some seats.
Yes.
And then there's the sentiment of Wexit.
Yeah, okay, right? That's absolutely
so,
fair. Yeah, yeah, okay.
I would say the Conservatives did make gains, yeah, in Delta, Ladner, or... I don't know, they might have already had Ladner. Sorry. I shouldn't be making claims that I don't have any facts on right now. But they had made gains in the lower mainland, but I don't think that the sentiment of actually separatism from Canada is really strong in BC.
Yeah.
I mean, right, like Alberta, this Wexit kind of sentiment seems to come from, A, there's been a lot of economic hardship in the oil sands, and I believe they feel like there's not been any attention paid to that, and even acknowledgement of the pain that has been happening in Alberta. And I mean, I feel like that's honestly a reasonable position to have from what I've seen from the media. Like, and it seems like a lot of people, even in Ontario, have such an opinion of Alberta as like, well, they were already the richest province. They, you know, they lost a few jobs. Their median income is still higher than Ontario. Mm-hmm. What are they complaining about? Mm-hmm. But... like, I mean, this is still a province that has lost a lot of what they had already had. Mm-hmm. So you can't just treat them with that kind of disdain, I guess.
But,
and so I think that's where, like, the Wexit is more coming from than actually from kind of a policy standpoint.
Yeah, I wonder, though, how much of... So I have kind of two questions I want to ask you about in terms of the Wexit sentiment in Alberta and Saskatchewan and a little bit in Manitoba. So, on the one hand, Alberta has a very high GDP per capita. I think it's like 70,000. Canada's only like 45 or 50. So, on the face of it, it seems quite high. But I wonder how much of that is just GDP accounting, right? There's a lot of processing and like value added, quote unquote, from, say, oil once it's put in the pipeline and gets shipped out of Alberta. But I wonder how much of that is actually seen by like the average Albertan.
Now, that's true.
I know, like public servants in Alberta, like, the way they describe things, like, their offices just seem to have better resources, and teachers seem to have access to iPads, and I'm like, we didn't have that in our school.
Oh,
so, like,
definitely not.
So there's definitely, like, a little bit more money there, but I'm not exactly sure how better off the average Albertan is to, say, the average Ontarian, for example.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting to look into. The last that I had seen was on Canada 338, was looking at when they had posted the median income per riding. And I had seen for most of Alberta where it was quite high. Now, I'm not sure actually how reliable Canada 338, though, is potentially. And so that would be something to certainly look into. But also, I mean, I think... the absolute amount of money that somebody has, I don't know if that actually really affects their anger at a certain point, right? I feel like people derive their well-being on a relative sense from year to year. And so if there has been a decline, even if they're still higher than the average Canadian, that anger could still be basically driven by that relative decrease in their personal assets, right? Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not they're actually richer than the rest of the Canadians... I'm not sure. And I don't know if that should necessarily factor into it. Anyway, I want to hear more of what you have to think on that.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering, though, like, how much of the Albertan wealth that we talk about in terms of, like, I agree, it seems odd that the federal government would be sending money to a province that has the highest GDP per capita. On the face of it, that does seem counterintuitive. But it could absolutely be the case that in the same way that the Republic of Ireland has an extremely high GDP per capita, but the average Irish person is not that wealthy, just simply because of the amount of corporate activity that's located there. And I wonder if something similar is also the case in Alberta. So when we're making these comparisons of GDP per capita being higher in Ontario relative to Alberta, I'd be surprised if it's actually that much higher, even once you adjust for that.
That's true.
And the other thing I'll mention is that to the extent that it is true that incomes are higher in Alberta, it's one of the last remaining provinces where the delta between earnings between someone with just a high school degree and an undergraduate degree is, I think, the lowest in Canada. As in, it's the last province where someone who doesn't have an advanced higher education degree can still earn a decent salary.
Yeah. Well, and I think that comes from the high skill demand for, I guess you could call it blue-collar work, but it's skilled labor that's not necessarily the skills you would pick up in a university, that's working on the oil fields, working in construction, or working in, you know, natural resource extraction. Yeah.
So related to that, let's talk about to what extent this Wexit narrative is actually legitimate. So we've identified that the average income, on the one hand, even if it is less than one would make it sound out based on just simple GDP numbers, right, Alberta is clearly a better off province. So does it make sense for Canadian public policy to address the either structural or cyclical economic issues that Alberta is experiencing right now, do you think? Because potentially of some, even if it is partly driven by our policies, actually, maybe even decompose that. First, how much is Alberta right in griping about policies coming out of Ottawa? The carbon tax has not even been imposed on them yet.
It has not, no.
No, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, if they had a leg to stand on, it would be that they could say the Liberal government has not done something to help them.
Mm.
They have also not done anything to hurt them, it seems like. Right? Like, I think a lot of those pipelines that they wanted to get through, those weren't necessarily existing. They had been languishing in the courts since Stephen Harper. No government's really been able to get those through. And now the Liberals have gone a step even further in actually putting federal money into buying the Northwestern Gateway pipeline. And so you could honestly say that the Liberals have done more in terms of how much money they've invested in trying to appease Alberta than even the Conservative government before it. So that's where I guess it gets fickle. Because the question you're asking is, are they justified in their feelings? But I don't know if... I feel like a lack of action or even a lack of results could potentially be a reason to be angry.
Like a lack of action from Ottawa.
Well, a lack of results, right? So, like, they've taken the action. They've bought this pipeline. It's still languishing in these courts. It's not getting built. The downturn that's been on the oil patch and on the oil sands is still happening. And so there's still pain that's happening in Alberta. I think you can still hold the federal government to task in that this is something that potentially they should have taken action on that they haven't been able to get any results on.
If I put on I don't want to use the word conspiratorial, but just in terms of seeing it in the most negative light that an Albertan might look at Ottawa's policies. So, you know, it's a political party, you have to spend your political capital wisely.
Yeah.
Whether or not you want to make sure that Bombardier, you know, keeps producing trains that may or may not be purchased by municipalities, or making sure that investment continues to flow into the oil sands, you have considerations about what your local, basically, political power base is interested in. But even putting that aside, that more people in Quebec vote for you than they do in Alberta, if you have to meet your 2030 Paris climate goals, and you know that just by your inaction alone, investment will start to decrease in the oil sands and cause your carbon output to go down, there's a sort of silver lining from your neglect of Alberta, right? Is you actually start to realize, it's like, you know, like, if the oil sands collapse, we're actually getting pretty close to our carbon targets, right? In which case, you can both use that in international arenas and to appeal to green voters. And I think Albertans appreciate that there's this narrative that, I don't know, I doubt Justin ever said it, but that he wants to kill the oil sands. In the same way that Trump talked about Hillary wanting to kill the coal industry, right? Like, no one actually thinks Justin wants to, well, no one serious thinks that he actually wants to kill it. But there's just this offsetting silver lining for the Liberal Party when the oil sands begins to shrivel away, right? Is that a legitimate view?
There's the difference between, I guess, Sorry. So the you're asking, is it a legitimate view to mm-hmm. see that Justin Trudeau uh-huh. is purposely collapsing the oil sands?
More that he, through benign neglect, he has other advantages. Like the collapse mm-hmm. of the oil sands benefits the Liberals through both the appeals to the environmental group and meeting carbon targets, and hence why he's just not going to wake up motivated every day to want to save this industry. That oh, to yeah, the extent sure. that it's saved causes him other headaches, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that isn't the way that you phrased it. I don't think is unreasonable to hope, because really, the Liberal government deciding to do nothing and letting the oil sands collapse. I mean, that's probably what they're actually doing, right? I mean, I believe that probably. Though the evidence is pointing actually against that, in the fact that they've wasted all of this federal money on purchasing this pipeline, and they're actively fighting it in the courts in order to get it passed. Mm-hmm. So they have literally done some actions in order to subsidize the oil sands in a way. but I mean, like, did the Liberals successfully save the auto industry in Ontario? Did the Liberals successfully save the softwood lumber industry in BC? I mean, both of those industries are a shadow of what they used to be. And I feel like this is a similar thing that's probably going to happen to the oil sands. But I don't know if it's... it's probably because it's too expensive for the government to actually step in and save it, right? Not so much... like, it's outside of the government's control that these shifts in the industry seem to be happening, right? Like, well, the auto sector in Canada, I'm not super aware of all the reasons why it's collapsing in Ontario, but I know there's been a lot of layoffs in GM in Oshawa, and that plant's not going to last for much longer. There's a lot of people that's whole lives depended on that. And even in 2008, they tried to bail it out, but these car companies are still leaving anyway. We go back to George W. Bush. I remember there was a lot of anger in BC about the NAFTA fights that we had over exporting softwood lumber to the States, and that basically collapsed a lot of the forestry industry in BC on a court case that went to the arbitration and ended up siding in Canada's favor, but the industrial damage was done and all the jobs are gone in BC for forestry from that point.
So yeah. I think the difference between... this is why politics is so interesting, is that... take the auto sector, right? We mm-hmm. agree that unless the government were to commit a wholly unrealistic amount of resources,
yeah.
a certain amount of shrinkage or collapse was just absolutely inevitable.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But no one could seriously claim that the provincial Liberal government at the time, or in Stephen Harper's Conservative government, didn't, within the bounds of Canadian political parameters, try to do a lot to save the auto sector. Right?
Yeah.
And there are probably a few more plants open now than there would be otherwise. Right, and yeah, there are still some like world like leading efficient plants. Like, I know Vic Fideli was bragging that like the Toyota's plant in, I'm not exactly sure where in Ontario, but it's one of the most efficient, like the JD Powers, like across the entire world, the most efficient like
wow.
manufacturing plant. Right, so like we
yeah.
still have some manufacturing in Ontario,
yeah.
and that's probably because of the equity
yeah.
investments in the 2008 to 2010 period.
Mm-hmm.
But in the oil sands, again, no one is with like. The moves towards carbon taxes across the globe and to need to cut our carbon emissions, like no one seriously thinks that the oil sands are going to be able to maintain their current level of output they had several years ago.
Yeah.
But the thing is whether or not there appears to be an attempt to at least try to stem some of the blood, right? So,
yeah.
right, and I think, and that's, I don't think that perception is wrong, that the Liberal Party would absolutely do everything they could to try to save a few factories in southern Ontario. And they
yeah,
will
they
not
might.
Do anything, basically, to save the oil sands. And I know when we
well,
talk about...
except for buy
the
pipeline.
Pipeline. Yes, but what does it mean to buy the pipeline? Is it,
well, it basically
$7 billion of government bonds that they don't have to pay for and they'll roll them over for the next 25 years? I mean, basically, the cost to the government and power is basically zero, right? I mean, like... Justin in the
cabinet. But you could say the same thing about the bailing out of those GM plants in 2008, where they just took some ownership and they ended up selling those back off. They just rolled the bonds over. It's a similar amount of effort.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of financial.
Yes.
I think it's more the political capital of there's only so many bureaucrats that can actually get things done in government. Mm-hmm. They only have so much time in a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree. I think there's more that could have been done in Alberta. But I think it would be unfair to say that the Liberals have done nothing, and I think they're getting more flack than they should be getting because they have bought the pipeline. So I would say both sides are wrong.
I don't think they bought the pipeline, though, to like the benefit of Alberta or the oil industry. I think they bought it because the Liberal Party in Canada is effectively the big business party. Now, the Conservative Party is the business party, but the Liberal Party is the party of TD, the law firms, basically the Canadian business establishment.
Yeah.
Right? And the Canadian business establishment is not going to be happy that their investments into companies that purchase these oil pipelines can basically be written down to zero, right? It was a bailout of large corporate interests, which the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party would be as equally sensitive to. I'm not saying that the Conservative Party is less concerned about what large businesses in Canada think.
So wait. Why don't you believe in the fact that Rachel Notley, whose NDP government was in Alberta, was lobbying Justin Trudeau to get that pipeline bought? Right, and that there was political pressure from that point of view because he'd struck that deal with Rachel Notley in order to get the carbon tax in Alberta, and so they'd promised that they would do what they could to get this pipeline put through.
That wasn't the only reason that they bought the pipeline, or even necessarily the primary reason. As you say, it could have been much more about interprovincial management of agreements with Rachel Notley's government to have the tax.
They even lost, like, Ralph Goodale lost his seat in Saskatchewan this particular election, and he was a very influential member of the Liberal Party, right?
Yes.
There would be strong voices that would have been pushing for this.
I mean, there are several other reasons that almost certainly superseded the need to encourage investment in the oil industry for why the Liberals bought the pipeline. Ranging from, as you say, their unofficial agreement with Rachel Notley to what the Canadian business lobbies would not have been happy, but a $6 billion project that had multiple financial backers could basically go to $0 because of a lack of ability to build it. Right? The business community would not have stood for that, right? I mean, the Financial Post would have been outraged.
I mean, maybe, yeah, I guess. I hadn't thought of it that way. Honestly, until you brought it up now, because I wasn't under the impression that a lot of big Canadian businesses had that much invested in that because it was who was the private company?
I think it was Enbridge.
Enbridge,
yeah, or I can't remember. No, and I'm not saying that say TD itself had a stake in it.
Some big business,
I don't even necessarily know, but more the principle that large corporate investments in Canada could basically go to zero overnight. Like the Canadian business and the companies themselves, bonds would have become more expensive because foreign investors now know, hey, we can put large investments in Canada and because of regulatory decisions, they could go to $0 overnight potentially.
Right.
Right. And the government was not willing to let that happen.
That wasn't actually a regulatory decision.
But
that was Enbridge backing out.
Because they couldn't.
Because they thought that it wasn't profitable.
But
how much is that also because the oil price is halved, right? And the money that a pipeline makes is based on the value of the goods it's transporting.
But the main reason is because the pipeline couldn't physically be built. Like, that is the primary reason why it was not a profitable pipeline. Because if the oil can't move through the pipeline, it can't, by definition, have any value. Right? For example, it could be completely an issue around Aboriginal title in BC, for all I know, as the main legal reason why we'll never have these pipelines to be built. I'm not even saying it's the Liberals' fault. I mean, that's completely beyond any political party's ability to control.
Yep.
I'm just saying is that the business community will always want large, multi-billion dollar investments to be bailed out by the federal government. Always. Right.
Well, yeah, they would want that kind of security.
Yes,
yeah, that's true.
And not even for their own investments, but just simply for when they borrow money from abroad, the interest rate they pay on their bonds would be lower.
Yeah.
It costs them nothing, effectively, and it cost the taxpayers everything, which is why it's a good, it's win, it's a win-lose.
Yeah, right? But I mean, we do still want other big projects to get built.
Yeah,
I guess. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we've talked about Wexit for a while now.
We have. I mean, it's a deep topic.
So I don't think Alberta's going to separate. Although the anger is there, I wonder if the return of the Bloc, though, realistically, if we had to bet if a province going to leave the country in the next 20 years...
Oh, no.
You don't think... Okay.
No. Well, I mean, if you list, like, Yves Blanchet, yes, there's a strong nationalist sentiment in Quebec, of Quebec first. But... Yves Blanchet, I don't think there was a very strong focus in his campaign on we're going to have another separation referendum, we're going to get out of this country, right? I think that it's almost like to get the Bloc back into the mainstream, he had to move away and say that decision was made, but I'm here to represent Quebec as a nation. And when Quebec wanted an alternative choice from the Liberals that would still represent Quebec as it's Quebecers' identity, right? Because that's the one thing that the Bloc and the Liberals really have in common that none of the other parties really have, I think, is that they both tend to represent the French Quebecers as their own people, right? Like, the Liberals, Justin Trudeau is a Montrealer. The Liberals are... They have kind of a cultural sense of them being a Quebec party. And that goes the same, I think, for the Bloc Québécois. And so if they... don't like if they don't like the Liberals, then where are they going to park their votes? They're going to want to still park it in a Quebec party, and so they went to the Bloc. And so I think like the Conservatives were unable to make any gains in Quebec because they don't have a Quebec identity as a party, and they don't, they're not seen to be represented there, right? I mean, that goes back, like, with the leadership race. The only time Kevin O'Leary has ever been correct was when he said Michael Bernier has to be the leader of the Conservative Party, otherwise we're going to get our asses kicked in Quebec. Mm. And he was right.
Well, Max didn't lose his seat.
Max also lost his seat. But I think if Maxime Bernier had been the leader of the Conservative Party, there'd be a much different demographic in Quebec.
Yeah.
Because they would have felt like they could vote Conservative without betraying their Quebec nationalism. Mm. Right?
She sidebar, if Max had have been the Conservative leader, do you think his policies that he had as the People's Party would have been the Conservative one, or do you think it would have been much more mainstream Conservative?
Well, I'm not even sure. Like, I'm actually having trouble parsing through what I felt about the People's Party of Canada. Maybe this is where we're going to get into some disagreement here, because after the election, there's been some kind of reports, especially from the CBC, about this smear campaign of portraying the People's Party of Canada as racists from the Conservatives because they were very afraid of a split on the right, similar to when there was the Alliance and the Progressive Conservative Party. And so I guiltily, I wrote off the People's Party as racists, probably because of the campaign from the Conservatives. Now, I don't think I would have voted for them even if I'd figured out what their politics are. Well, because they Maxime Bernier doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
But I think the policies of the Conservative Party would have been different, but I don't think they would be drastically different, because I think the perception of the People's Party of Canada is incorrect about what their actual platform is. Like, I don't think it's actually... Like, they were very pay down the deficit, which actually wasn't what the Conservative Party was for. And, I mean, the other thing was, I think they were, well, Maxime, if I remember from the debates, was arguing for Quebec's own rights on the niqab ban, and the, or sorry, not the niqab ban, on the religious symbols ban, right? So... I imagine it would still be a form of small C conservatism, but maybe it would have been more upfront about we don't believe in climate change.
Hmm. Yeah. So, well, first of all, it's interesting that you say that the Conservatives had the smear that they were racist. I mean, I agree that the Conservatives launched the largest attack against the People's Party because they had the most to lose from their presence. Mm-hmm. And they should get some credit for having completely obliterated them.
They destroyed them, yeah.
Off the political map in Canada. Yeah. But from what, I mean, just based on the debates, and I don't follow NDP or Green talking points as much, but mm-hmm. the racist claims were coming from, like, Jagmeet Singh, and I thought from the left is where the People's Party's racism was being attacked mainly from the left, whereas what I heard from Scheer on the debates was that Max was a hypocrite and that he was divisive, which is a lot more of a soft way of saying racist than what I heard more from the left. So I think the left was much more sensitive to Max's arguments. Now, what could be called unfair is saying reducing the flow, the annual flow of immigration amounts to a racist policy. Although it does stand in contrast to the Conservative Party's, well, at least in modern histories, like, political coalition, where they've tried to deliberately build recent immigrant communities into their coalition. Right?
Well, yeah, they had tried to do that.
So that would be a big split right there. So Max would basically be shifting seats away from the 905 towards Quebec, right? That would have had to have happened, right, for him to have...
Well, I don't know if that's actually true. I mean, I'm not sure if immigrants are more pro-immigration, actually. I don't have any statistics or numbers on this. Anecdotally, I've talked to some people whose parents are the immigrants that came over, and they're very pro-reducing immigration. And because they feel like that would put a danger on the stability that's already in Canada. Even though, I mean, talking to these people, I'm only talking to the children of, so this is kind of secondhand. They've said, well, we've tried to point out to our parents that they were given this opportunity to come to Canada. Why shouldn't more people be given this opportunity? And they would say, well, because that opportunity's gone, and I made my own way, and that was very hardworking, and none of these immigrants necessarily are the same, right? So I don't know if actually being anti-immigrant would actually have lost in the 905 or even turn some of these newer Canadian blocs against the Conservative Party.
I agree that there is a world in which, and it could completely be true, that just in isolation asking people who are first and second generation immigrants, if we reduce the annual flow from 300,000 to 200,000, do you support this policy? Mm-hmm. The majority of the plurality may say yes to that. But in the context of structuring a political party, who then the candidates you attract because you've announced that message, I think will necessarily alienate, right? And so the attacks about the People's Party's racism, like, it was just simply because every one of their candidates, well, not every one, but every other one, you just had to go through about 4 seconds of scrolling through their Facebook feeds before you found something absolutely both hilarious and horrifying at the same time. And this is completely identical to the experience that the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, had when they were setting up their party, which was an explicit, we need to reduce the flow of immigration. And Nigel Farage kept stressing, like, this is such a hard job because I need to basically police every single candidate we've ever had in our party. And that's why UKIP, for example, will not allow anyone who was ever part of the British National Party, which is, I don't think technically neo-Nazi, but like some of their friends are probably neo-Nazis or something, right? So, like, the point is that Nigel Farage has been so careful about who he let into the party, and even they were plagued by every third candidate rather than every second one having some sort of questionable past. And the moment Nigel Farage left UKIP, then suddenly former British National Party executives were being parachuted into the leadership of that party. So I think it's just, the problem is once you construct a party's narrative around this, even if theoretically that policy can be benign or maybe even wise, you just attract a weird and strange set of people. And I've been kind of going on for a while now, I remember the People's Party, they were protesting during Pride Week outside of the Surrey RCMP headquarters because they were raising a pride flag and there should only ever be a Canadian flag. I mean, just goofy things like that. Like, these are the people that are attracted to your party. Like, why would you want to be a member of that party, right?
Yeah, but I think you're... So, here's where I think we're getting a bit off course. I think you're conflating the then racism that was inherent in the candidates, because A, when you form a new party, you have no history of getting good candidates. You have nobody that seriously wants to win that's actually going to try and join your party. So you're going to get the people that are most excited about your party, which are people that are not represented in the other parties. And so then if you have anything that hints of racism, you're going to get the people that are avidly racist because they're very passionate about racism to come and join your party. So that, and that's one aspect of the People's Party. But the other aspect was, is the platform. And if Maxime Bernier had then been the leader of the Conservative Party and brought his platform ideas there, would it have still been racist? And to that I would say then no, because all of the candidates would have already had valid, like, good quality people would have been their potential members of parliament, right? Because they already had the infrastructure and the history of being an established party with established small C conservatives that would be willing to run for the Conservative Party. And so you wouldn't have had that racist bent by only being able, because Maxime Bernier, honestly, was desperate for anybody to stand up and say, I'll run as a PPC person, right? So he had to take what he could get, and I think that is more why there was such a racism influx, right? Because they saw that as the only party that they could even then try to get their policies in place.
Although, right? The one thing Max did not have to do was actually have a cross-the-country candidate rollout. He could have targeted his riding, saying, like, this is the first year we're a new party. We're going to pick the first 20 ridings we think that we can get the best people.
And he could have, but I think he was way too overconfident. Yeah. He thought that he could just crush it, which obviously he couldn't.
No. Okay, so...
So I think hubris did him in there.
So speaking of Max's rejection of human-based climate change...
Jesus. Yeah.
You personally think that addressing climate change should probably be the number one priority of all governments on planet Earth currently.
Right? I do, yeah.
So we've seen the screeching and the hollering of a $20 a ton tax that has not even yet been implemented in provinces that are complaining about it.
Yeah.
But we need to go to at least $200 mm-hmm. a ton, tenfold increase in the next 10 years, and even that Elizabeth May says is just a joke and won't actually do anything. That's just like to meet targets that were signed by Stephen Harper, not ones that are actually linked up with the most recent IPCC report.
Yeah.
So how on earth is that going to happen? And do we need to abandon the tax route to get to these targets?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think the tax route is the most efficient and the cleanest way to do it. And I think you agree with me, right? But I think it's the least politically palatable because there's such anger towards taxation.
One thing that economists have been criticized since like mm-hmm. the Great Recession is that their focus on efficiency has missed important distributional consequences, right? So it's true that the tax is the most efficient in the sense that we will get this, the highest amount of aggregate GDP that would be possible, mm-hmm. given a certain tax rate.
Yeah.
But if the distributional consequences are such that people that are, have already been hurting because, say, it hits people that have lower levels of education just because of geography, or it hits provinces that have these downturns like Alberta that we've just been discussing,
yeah.
like, should we even be thinking about economic efficiency as opposed to just looking more at the distributional consequences and political consequences, like even just wearing an economic hat? Because if economist policies aren't being adopted, doesn't it need to be rethought, the strategy?
Yeah, I agree. I think if it is targeting, like, I mean, we already know a consumption tax will more unfairly target people out of the lower income, because any consumption tax that's a flat rate on all goods, that's going to take up a huge percentage of their income because they just don't actually make as much as someone that's incredibly wealthy. And so you can look at a carbon tax, excuse me, sorry, because oil is literally
an input to almost every single consumption good as basically another consumption tax. So, yeah, I think there's certainly an argument from that kind of economics perspective that finding a different route to tackle it is also good. Now, I don't think we should just toss out the carbon tax. Like, we should do all these things, right? And I think maybe if we start thinking about the carbon tax at $200, where that's going to be an increase of 40 cents a liter, maybe that's where we say that's a little bit too much. We need a different... We need to start targeting other ways of reducing carbon emissions because that's unfairly targeting the poorest people in our society, right?
One thing I always kind of puzzled over is, like, despite, like, the vision and the grand ambitions people have for reducing carbon emissions in countries, they don't seem to think that actually... Like, just simple design changes or just looking at the margins of where carbon is intensive can make a difference. So let me clarify what I mean by that is, so the average Torontonian's carbon emissions is probably one quarter of their counterparts that live in rural areas and maybe half in suburban areas.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So instead of treating the existing geographical distribution as fixed... And what you're maximizing is basically the elasticity of the tax response.
Mm-hmm.
What if instead we focused on, we want basically, if Canada's population is going to be 40 million by, I don't know, 2045,
yeah.
We want the next 7 million people to come to Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal,
yeah.
Right? Basically have massive building campaigns, getting people to live into small shoeboxes that are energy efficient to heat, and you can walk around. I'm just surprised that that's not a policy strategy that people discuss. Get people to move to cities. Right?
Well, because I think if we go back to the political reality, I think that would be even less politically palatable than a carbon tax. Because if you're going to start telling people that live in the country that it's too expensive for them to live the way they want to live their lives, that would invoke way more anger than just charging them more at the gas pump. Even.
No, but what I'm not saying that you tell people, like, leave the countryside. I'm just saying is what you have campaigns for is massive building opportunities where you say, we want to build another 7 million housing units in these three downtown areas in the next 10 years, right? In the same way that people with high school degrees aren't upset if you say, we want to expand higher education opportunities by, like, a million student spots. You don't have high school students saying, it's like, oh, I can't believe that they're, like, you know... looking down on my degree, right? Like, people in the countryside won't be upset if you say, we want to build 7 million new housing units. I mean, they might complain that, you know, if we're not receiving infrastructure, it's because you're spending it all downtown. Like, you have to balance that. But I think you can easily craft it so it doesn't seem divisive.
Right. So you would just, as, like, a carrot policy is what you're proposing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this too before, in that there's a bit of a housing crisis in any of these. Like, well, Toronto and Vancouver, it seems for some reason the price of housing is not rising in the same way in Montreal. But
it's rising, it's just at a much lower level.
At a much more reasonable level. Anyway, it's crazy how fast it's been rising in Toronto and Vancouver. It seems like, for me, living in Toronto. I agree. To tackle even that problem, there should be way more construction in these cities. Like, I go into downtown Toronto and see all these single detached houses. I'm like two blocks away from Bay Street. How the heck is this a house here? Why is this not an apartment building? I completely agree with that.
And why doesn't the Green Party talk about it? Why don't I ever hear Elizabeth May saying, we need to get everyone living in the downtown core?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That is a very good point.
It's the same reason we don't hear them talking about nuclear energy. It's just because...
Nuclear energy is very unpopular.
Yes, but that's... But what I mean is that we, as a society, we have an anti-urban bias. I mean, like, it's just... You don't get points by saying we need to be living in small, cramped apartment buildings in the downtown area. That's just not the view. I mean, it goes all the way back to, like... social democrats in the 1930s and the 1940s, when they're thinking of workers' cities, they have these, like, garden-type cities they're imagining. There's just... Even the left has this weird romantic vision of how people should be living. And I think the conservatives have this idea of, like, a a middle class yeomanry farmers, right? Like everyone has these weird ideas of like what makes this kind of rugged middle class country, and for some reason a downtown urban lifestyle is not part of that vision.
Yeah, it does seem like there is in North America such a ingrained sense in our culture of having large plots of land, right? And for some reason that is like something that everyone aspires to, is like, I want to have the front yard, the backyard, the big house. I don't want anybody living above me or below me. And for some reason, because that's part, I guess, of our identity, that's really hard to let go of. I can't tell you why the Green Party has not embraced that. But I imagine that maybe it does have something to do with that identity that you've touched on.
I think it's just ideological blind spots that both the left and the right have, actually.
Yeah, makes sense.
So speaking of the Green Party, they won. They took a few seats, but they got a lot of the vote, the popular vote.
Yeah.
Around 8%, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just very spread out.
Right, very spread out.
Yeah.
I know you're in favor of some type of change to Canada's electoral system. So two questions. First, were you disappointed that Justin didn't deliver on that in his first mandate? And second, what is your vision for a changed electoral system in Canada?
Was I disappointed? Actually, I was fairly all right with how the Liberals had handled it personally. Because I liked the Liberals. They employed Vox. They went out and they did this poll. I participated in that poll when I got my summons. And the findings from that poll, I mean, I guess maybe if you don't trust an independent pollster to report accurate things, then maybe you don't necessarily like what they did. But I trust that what they came back with was that, you know, about 50% of Canada still wants to stay with the same system. And it was, the rest were kind of split between all the other systems. So there was no, and I think, right, to change any political system, you need a supermajority. Because that's such a fundamental part of the process of the transition of power from one election to the next. It's very important. Now, theoretically, I don't like first past the post because of some of its consequences. But I recognize and respect the findings of that poll and the Liberals saying we don't actually think there's enough support in Canada to change the way we elect officials. And I know for the individuals who then only voted Liberal because Justin said that they were going to change the voting system, that that doesn't ring true to them, because their reality is that if they dislike first past the post this much, everyone must dislike first past the post this much. But I think that's just not what that poll had found. And you can't just upend the entire system like that. And I think it was politically savvy for Justin Trudeau to promise that, because I think there was a change in the votes, and he gained more votes that way. But in the long run, that did disillusion some of those people that voted for him. And so maybe it was a mistake in that sense, and that he shouldn't have promised that without actually knowing that people wanted to change the voting system. Because I know there was that, sorry, I'm going a little bit long, but there was that referendum in BC to go to mixed member proportional, and that didn't pass. And that's, so I mean, if you even just look in BC, I mean, it's not the whole country, but they were not in favor of getting rid of the first past the post there. Why would you assume that the trend would be vastly different for the whole of Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you're saying makes sense. But if we did have a change in the system, what do you think would be the best?
Yeah, okay. I like single transferable vote. And I like single transferable vote because I like the way that it allows a voter to basically add additional information into their single ballot. It allows you to say, oh, I like the Green Party the best, but I'm okay with the NDP. After that, I like the Liberals, and then lastly, Conservatives, and I'm just going with a stereotypical left-winger for my example here. And I think that that extra information allows the political parties, A, to adjust their platforms better, it allows people to not feel as disillusioned with the system because, yeah, their party didn't necessarily win a seat in their local riding, but they were able to voice their opinion about them being their favorite choice without jeopardizing or without risking their ballot being in favor of their least favorite, right? And so, for me, that's kind of why I like single transferable vote. And then you can still have kind of only MPs that are regional, because you can have, instead of just a single MP, there's a group of five MPs that are elected for your region. And so, I think that it's just, it's more balanced. It ticks the boxes that my subjective view prefers.
Yes, I understand that. So let me tell you why I don't like the single transferable vote. So what I do think would be a better system, which is related to the single transferable vote but not identical, mm-hmm. is a runoff system. So this idea that you might have four or five candidates to start with, mm-hmm. you don't want a situation where, like take, say, Vancouver Granville, where Jody Wilson won with only 30% of the vote because you had, you know, 30 for Jody, 27 for the Liberals, 20 for the Conservatives, right? Yeah. Yeah. So it makes sense that you want to have a second round with the top two candidates, say, mm-hmm. and then people can finally commit. The thing I worry about with the single transferable vote is that you have a lot of people that are being like, I'll just make sure that the Liberals are, like, a safety just in case, right? So people on the right are like, well, okay, I don't want, like, a crazy person from the Green Party to win, so I'll put the Liberals as my backup. People from the left being, well, I don't want the Conservatives to win, so I'll put the Liberals as my backup just in case. But you could easily imagine if there was a second round between the Liberals versus the NDP or the Liberals versus the Conservatives, they would not win the second round. Possibly.
Yeah, but then doesn't that make it more so that then, right, okay, so say the Green Party and the Liberals and the Conservatives are the most popular, and say the NDP is the second choice for everyone. Just a completely fictional scenario here. So the Liberals and the Conservatives, but everyone that votes Conservatives, their least favorite's the Liberal. Everyone that votes Liberal, their least favorite's the Conservative. And then so they always put the NDP as their second pick, right? Now, both the Conservatives and the Liberal make it to the runoff, but only one of them can win. So roughly half of the vote has their least favorite candidate, and roughly half of the vote from the other one has their least favorite candidate, instead of shoehorning in the NDP, who is all right for everyone, right? Wouldn't the member that is in the middle be preferable for everyone?
So this is the problem that I have about, like, single transferable vote. We could easily imagine, I don't know if easily is the right word, we could have, like, a dual transferable vote,
right?
We can
always add more dimensions.
This is the problem, is actually, like, ranking intensity of preferences, which is what I don't like about the single transferable vote, is that the transfer just becomes the, like, I might want to put, this is where, say, if I had, like, an election budget, you know, you could easily imagine the case where someone who's, like, center left, they might say put five for the Liberals and four for the NDP and, I don't know, one for the Green Party, right? Where someone who's conservative might put nine for the Conservatives and one for the Liberals, right? That their ranking of intensity is just much higher, right? And so this is why, if we had to adjust the system, I would still prefer mixed member, because first past the post at least has a strong, if you are voting for someone, you really do believe it, in the sense that if even if you are the Green Party, you know you don't win and you vote for them, like, you get the strong vote for it. Now, because you get the to compensate for the strategic issues that then come up from that, that's why I support the popular thing of it, which is that, like, okay, you want to have people have strong support, but then they might start to feel that they're throwing away their vote by voting for the Green Party, so then they start to act strategically. That seems unfortunate.
Yeah.
So then we move to the pure popular vote, in which case it's just you throw all your election budget at one person,
mm-hmm.
right? But you still preserve the regional influence, and you don't deal with this sort of soft middle party that gets the meh part.
I don't know. I don't see... Wait, by having the budget as opposed to having the single transferable vote.
The thing I'm based... So that I wasn't particularly articulate with what I was advocating there, but the key point, from my view anyway,
mm-hmm.
is that intensity of voting matters,
mm-hmm.
And the single transferable vote does not capture that?
The intensity of voting matters.
Yeah. But I don't know if the budget, like, so you'd, but the intensity is still captured in that you still put who you want first, and you can still choose to put no one second, and then your vote gets thrown away if your candidate's not.
Here's an alternative single transferable vote system that has a budget, right?
Yeah.
So let's say you can only rank two people, and you can divide your budget with 10
mm-hmm.
units, okay? So I put conservatives as 7, and I put the liberals as 3, for example.
Okay?
We drop the rounds, and we sum up the totals, and the conservative party is now wiped off. They were the bottom-ranked party,
yeah.
right? Now, my 7 points disappears into the ether,
yeah.
and my 3 points goes up to the liberals.
Okay.
And that's how it works. So that the intensity of vote, that when I'm committing to the conservatives and I give them a disproportionate share... What I'm saying is that in the second round of the transfer, because I really don't care that much about the liberals, they're going to get a smaller transfer, whereas in the standard single transferable vote, it's 100% to 100%, right? My conservative, if I rank conservatives as 1 and liberals as 2, my conservative 1 disappears into the ether if the conservatives are the bottom-ranked party
mm-hmm.
in round 1 elimination, and then all of my budget goes to the liberals. So I don't get to preserve any of the strength that I have, that I'm really not that into the liberals, they're just... really my, like, washy second, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so, but then that would mean, though, still you could have a minority of people who are then just, like, all in one party, and another party that's, like, not quite all in, but they also got a bunch of washies from another people that then would still lose them. So you could still have rule by the minority, though.
Yes, yes, of course. But what I'm saying is that, like... What I worry about is that the single transferable vote will look as though there's a rule by the majority. But if we look at weighted, it's not a weighted majority, right? So we're bumping up against the fact that you can't construct a political voting system that satisfies numbers of axioms at the same time.
I think they've shown mathematically
yes.
that it's impossible
Arrows
to do
of
this.
Possibility theorem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think that this the weighting, well, A, that's fairly complicated.
I don't want that system. Just to be clear, I don't
oh,
want
just...
a weighted. I'm just giving the example of why it is the case that single transferable vote doesn't capture the intensity of voting. That I'm
yeah.
trying to preserve.
I mean, I think, though, the intensity of voting doesn't get captured in first past the post either, right? I mean, I feel about any party, and I'm going to pick one because I feel passionate about voting, but I may not give a shit about whoever gets in. Sorry.
Yeah, no, explicit. But that's see, you do represent the preserved intensity in first past the post doesn't faze you or me. Neither of us, I think, vote strategically, probably.
Mm, no.
But some people do. And because that happens, I acknowledge that we might need an alternative system to capture some of those voting pathologies that come in because of the design of the system.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like... I think I agree with you in terms of like the intensity of the voting maybe should matter. But I think the bigger problem is, what people hate should trump what people love, I think. And so I think that's something with, like, the single transferable vote. Maybe that was the wrong way to say it. Something with the single transferable vote is that you basically are picking your second because you dislike somebody else more, right? Like, because if you were completely uncaring about the third and fourth parties, and the second, third, or fourth parties, you could just put your first party down, leave the rest blank, right? So the only reason to actually spend the effort to think about ranking the rest of the parties would be if there was some passion within you of a difference between those two. And so, yes, it's not as fine-grained as if you had some weighting, but I think that your vote should matter just as much if you are meh versus hate two parties as love versus meh, right? And so that's why I think your whole vote would need to go with the second person.
Yeah, it just no, I understand what you're saying. I'm just saying is we could imagine an election where every winning candidate was never the first ranked choice of any voter.
Yeah, but I think that that's like a preferable outcome, right? That's a preferable outcome to a party that gets in where it was only the first choice of 30% of the people. Right?
And,
the last choice of everyone else.
I actually understand because you are an extreme centrist. You really want to average out to zero.
Well, yeah, because I think that people's fear of some party getting in should trump their love of one party getting in. Right? It's like, I don't know. It was like when we had, maybe just to bring it down to a stupid example, when we're like picking what food we're going to have for some party. If anyone hates a food, that's like a veto. Mm-hmm. But you then pick the most favorite out of none of the vetoed options.
Yeah, but
right?
I agree that is the perfect analogy to capture what you're describing. I don't think that's a good thing, though. I think that actually it's better to, sometimes you need to select over variation. So actually having larger swings in policy outcomes because some extreme voters can have large influences. I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. I think that if humans, as a tendency, will always try to reduce variation and benefits them at an individual level, but it hurts everyone overall. Like, I just mean like in a game theoretic sense, right? Like people, just as this is generally what happens, right? Is that mm-hmm. people will always minimize the variation that they experience for themselves.
Yeah.
But we know that globally we need some amount of variation, right? Like people prefer to live in an economy where they basically have no economic risks.
Yes.
But we know if economic risk disappeared, innovation and a lot of the dynamism we have will just go away.
There would be no progress.
There would be very little progress. It would be a lot harder to deliver progress. And that's what I like. Now, maybe you don't want political systems to have that level of dynamism.
Yeah, I mean, is the government supposed to be dynamic?
So there's a difference between the bureaucracy supposed to be dynamic as opposed to our political parties supposed to be dynamic,
yeah.
Right? I think you can have both. You can have like a taming bureaucracy.
But like, I don't know. I see the goal, right? It's not about adding variance into the government or the way the country's run. It's about coming up with this election system that gets closest to the wants of the majority, right? The wants of the populace. What system puts in place the party that is closest to what most people wanted, or to what everyone wanted?
But
right?
Actually, to use your own words, it would be to elect the party that will do the things that the most number of people don't want, that won't do what the most number of people don't want to have done.
Yeah, well, yeah, the things that people don't want to have done will trump the things that people want to have done sometimes.
Yeah, but I think right now I can imagine a world where we might want to move towards that dimension, but I feel that the issue we have in contemporary societies in Western countries is actually a lack of political entrepreneurship, right? Like, I think that the era in which there was, like, both nationalization and then privatization. I mean, we are very much on a stable political course. Like, the major parties don't really have that much policy differences. I think actually we would benefit by a little more dynamism in the political system, right? We're not going to be able to... Now, the thing is that there are a lot of issues we need to address with, like, big policy changes. Now, the risk is that, by definition, if there are differing views, one has to be bad and one has to be good. So potentially we could have a disastrous response to climate change. Or we could have a good response to climate change. But the system we're going to have now is, and not that I'm a fan of Elizabeth May in terms of policy space, but she's right. It's like, it's a moot point. It's like, sure, like maybe we'll hit our targets that Stephen Harper signed, but we now know that those aren't scientifically sufficient, right?
But that's to prevent a specific outcome, right? I think what Elizabeth May is missing is that any reduction in carbon still ameliorates the future, right? Whether we hit that 1.5 degrees Celsius or not, 2.5 is better than 3, right? And so some, like, that's like, you don't throw out the partial solution because it's not perfect, right? And so I feel like we need to at least be doing what we're doing. And I would fight tooth and nail for every reduction in carbon tax, even if the most that I can possibly eke out is not going to hit, is not going to keep us under 1.5, because I want to keep us as low as possible.
Yeah.
It's not about some binary cutoff.
You're right. There are probably some policy spaces where the gradient has, maybe not, it's probably non-linear in that, like, you know, 2 to 2.5 is much different than 2.5 to 3, for example.
Well, I think it's, like, I would say it's greater, like, it's super linear,
yeah,
the growth, right? 2.5 to 3 is a worse damage,
yeah,
than 1.5 to 2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah. But like, we at least agree that, like, the benefits are at least scaling somewhat.
We know
what the function is. But
yeah,
there are other policies where, like, you're either really going to come up with a solution or you're not. Like, you're either going to have an effective response to, like, say, automation through AI, or you're not. And you're either basically going to be able to have a monetary policy system that is able to actually, like, you know, meet an inflation rate that basically spurs macroeconomic growth, or you're not. There's not going to be some in-between. I mean, there might be some in-between response, but I think it will be pretty limited. I think a lot of the problems basically need bold responses. Right. And I don't think, whereas literally the carbon issue is a mapping of X input to X output has a nice kind of scaling effect.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of policies have that, which is why having the washy middle might not be the best.
But I think, I mean, that's a different issue though then, right? Like, that's a fundamental disagreement with democracy, right? Because that's saying that what most people want in the country is not extreme enough to deal with the problems that the country has. But that's, like, fundamentally undemocratic to have a government that's not as close as possible to what most people want.
Yes. Right? But as Sir Humphrey once said, Jared, we have a British democracy.
We do have a British democracy. Yeah. I'm a royalist.
Yeah, why don't we end with that? So, would you be horrified if someone proposed turning Canada into a republic?
Into a republic?
Yeah.
Yeah, get rid of the Queen?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, fuck that.
Yeah.
No. I'm keeping my queen. I like the queen. I don't want to be a republic. I like the monarchy. I'm wishy-washy on the Senate. But yeah. Even just as, like, a figurehead, I find that there's cultural value. And even in the nation's identity is having some kind of royalty that's there. Because the effect that they're having on the country outside of that cultural effect is very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I'll fight wars in the name of the Queen. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. I honestly didn't know you were that much of a royalist, but I appreciate it. I will have 2 points I want to make on it, just so this is in the public record as clear as possible. One, any move to remove Canada's constitutional monarchy will instantaneously require a huge political constitutional amendment, just simply for the fact that replacing the governor general is the mechanism for how parties form government. Now, of course, you could have a independent governor general that was appointed by some body that wasn't the Queen. But realistically, if you're going to create a whole new position to decide who forms government, you're effectively having a constitutional discussion about what is our political system, which gets back to first past the post. Inevitably, this would come up. So removing the Queen amounts to basically a complete rediscussion of whether or not we preserve our existing political system. So that's challenging. Second, and I was reading Jody's Wilson-Raybould's book, From Where I Stand, recently.
Okay.
And not that she made this point explicitly, but when I was reading about the different landmark Aboriginal title cases, so like Calder 73, Delgamuukw 97, Tsilcotin 2014, a BC case that was really important. All of these are based on, in part, I mean, they make reference to the 1763 royal proclamation that King George III made. Mm-hmm. So I wonder to what extent, if we abolish the monarchy, the underlying Aboriginal title claims could be at risk. Which is another fascinating thing to think about, basically all of the things that were done in the name of the crown, right. whether or not that gets instantly preserved once we remove...
If we remove
the monarchy.
Yeah,
which is a really interesting thing to think about, how that would impact the jurisprudence of it. And again, not in a good way. It would add total chaos and uncertainty.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that would all depend on in what context is the transition away from the monarchy happening.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Is this the American Revolution?
Yeah.
Or is this a slow transition away? Right.
Yeah, and there's no technical... Again, this could all be codified in law. We could pass legislation saying that all laws and treaties signed under the crown are hereby supported by the new Canadian government. Right? This all can mm-hmm. be done technically. There's nothing technical that couldn't be done by our government that's done by the monarchy now.
Yeah.
But simply doing it would be such a headache and a disaster. Yeah. I think it would be Brexit-like, potentially, actually.
Yeah. I think it's like it's an incredible amount of work for... For what?
For what? Yeah, exactly. To be able to cut off our heritage and our cultural ties.
How many people get pissed off about that?
Yeah,
I mean, I get pissed off about that.
Yeah, it would upset me too. Well, this has been a great discussion, Jared. I think our inaugural statistically insignificant podcast has been a success.
Yeah, I mean, if anything else, it's going to be long.
Yes. I think our plus 1 hour discussion may be a little unfiltered, but seeing as it's our first podcast, I think it was still a good go.
Yeah, I think this was a good pilot run.
And sure. And the fact that we ended on a point of agreement about the awesomeness of the monarchy was a plus I had not anticipated.
That's good. All right. Well, this is Jared Hunter from Statistically Insignificant saying farewell, as well as my co-host here,
Eric Drysdale.
All right, good night.
Bye.